That hymn, "Thine Is the Glory," is quite an energetic song. Would you agree? I'm feeling bouncing from it still. I want to dance from it. It's kind of cool. I came across a really cute little joke, Easter joke, this week, and I thought I'd share it with you. Imagine three gentlemen are at the gates of heaven, and there's St. Peter waiting for them. And St. Peter says to them, "You may not know this, but you actually have to answer a question about religion in order to get into heaven." Three gentlemen look a little bit concerned. So Peter turns to the first gentleman and says, "What is Easter?" And the gentleman thinks for a moment, and he says, "Is that when you have a turkey and you have pumpkin pie and it happens at the end of the harvest?" And St. Peter goes, no, that's Thanksgiving. That's got nothing to do with Easter." So he turns to the second gentleman and he says to him, same question, "What is Easter?" And that gentleman thinks for a moment and says, "Was that when you go out into the field and you cut the tree down and you bring it back and you decorate it and you put presents under the tree and then you give the presents away and you go to church? Is that Easter?" And St. Peter, he frowns again. No, that's Christmas. It's important, but it's not Easter. So he turns to the third man and he says to them the same question, "What is Easter?" And that gentleman thinks for a moment and then he answers, "Is that when Jesus gets arrested? And then he gets a trial and he gets convicted. The Romans crucify him on a cross. He dies. They bring him down. Some of his disciples put him in a shroud and they put him into a tomb." Now, St. Peter, he's ecstatic. Yes, that's it. He turns to the other two gentlemen and says to them, "You should have paid more attention on earth when these things were being talked about." And the third man continues, "And if Jesus comes out in 3 days, that means we have 6 more weeks of winter?" Yeah? I don't think St. Peter was too happy about that, was he? What is Easter, though? If you were at the gates of heaven and St. Peter asked you that question, "What is Easter?" what would your response be? Now, of course, in the Protestant tradition, we don't really believe St. Peter is the guardian or the gatekeeper of heaven. But say it turns out that's the case, and you're up at the gate of heaven, at the pearly gates, and there's St. Peter, and he asks you the question about religion, "What is Easter?" What are you going to say back to him? Do you know what Easter is? Like what it really is? Could you explain it to Peter if you had to? I mean, Easter is the essential claim of the earliest church. It was a simple message, really. Jesus Christ raised from the dead. Jesus Christ resurrected. Jesus Christ crucified, died, buried, raised to new life. And this claim of resurrection goes back to the very beginning of the church. It's not an add-on that came 100 or 200 years later. It's not a legendary development. It didn't even come 50 years, not even 20 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. It's a part of the story from the beginning. There is no story of crucifixion in the church without resurrection. New Testament scholars generally believe, whether they're believers or skeptics, that the message of Jesus' resurrection goes back right to the essential beginning of the whole Christian church. Right back to the beginning. Claim of resurrection and crucifixion goes right back to the source of our Christian traditions. We see it in Paul's formulation in 1 Corinthians 15. He says this, "For what I received I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures." There's thought to be an ancient hymn in that tradition that Paul passes on to the Corinthians, a tradition that he had been given himself, a hymn he had been taught in those early years in the mid-30s when he went to meet Peter and James and John and other disciples of Jesus. Right after he'd had his Damascus Road experience, he went off into Arabia for a period of time. He came back to Jerusalem, and it's there they think that Paul was introduced to this formula, died, buried, raised. And this was this formula, this little hymn, was something that was part of the tradition that Paul passed on to the Corinthians in the church in Corinth. So that within 2 years of the date of Jesus' crucifixion, then this tradition was rooted in the practice of the early church. Some scholars, like James Dunn, says it goes back to within 6 months of the crucifixion of Jesus, and that crucifixion-resurrection dynamic was modeled in a little hymn within 6 months of that moment, which means that the earliest disciples, the very first disciples of Jesus, had put together a simple expression of their new reality. As again, I mentioned to you, this means the resurrection of Jesus was not some late legendary add-on, some later embellishment. The claim of Jesus' resurrection goes back to the first disciples of Jesus. Now, if those first disciples of Jesus, and I was mentioning to you this a little bit last week, was if they were making up the whole story about that post, about their post-death experiences of Jesus, you would have to wonder why they wouldn't have picked an easier way of going about it. Something a bit easier to sell to the world around them. Because there were so many knocks against this story of Jesus being raised bodily from the dead, it would have pushed so many buttons in those early Jews and those early Gentiles and the non-Jews of the times. Everyone would have had some basic problem with the story. It would have been so much easier in the world of the first century to have created a story about having a vision of Jesus. That would have been easy. Post-death visions were common in the ancient world. They're even common today in most of the world around us. Just talk about a vision of seeing Jesus translated from death, the grave, into heaven. That would have been pretty easy to sell to the world. The Jewish high priest Ananias, they got a little picture there. If you sit there, it's a little... No, that's not Ananias. So, well, we won't worry about that. There he is, okay. It's not a story that most of you are familiar with because it's not in our Bibles, in 2 Maccabees, which is an intertestamental writing around 150 BC. But Ananias was the high priest of the temple, and he was murdered by the emperor or the king of Syria. And then a few years later, there's a war between the Greeks and the Jews, and they have this major struggle going on. And this leader of the Jews at the time has a vision of Ananias. He has a vision. He sees Ananias praying to God. Ananias is on the right there. He's praying to God. In the vision also is the prophet Jeremiah. The prophet Jeremiah is giving a gold sword to the commander of the Jewish army and promises of victory. That was a huge vision. And it was an inspiring story of faith for the Jewish people in their struggle for freedom from the Greek Empire. And it was completely within everybody's frame of reference. There was no difficulty of anyone, Greek or Jew, accepting and assimilating this vision into their understanding of reality, into their understanding of life and death, into their understanding of human destiny. And it made a major contribution. This story made a major contribution to the Jews' ultimate victory over the Greeks and their freedom. There's the story of Julius Caesar, the great dictator and general of Rome. When he died, people had visions of him ascending to the gods. Caesar was murdered by his political enemies. His ascent was seen as a vindication of his life. And that kind of report was easily embraced by people. People got it. It didn't challenge their basic frame of life. Dead people stay dead, yes, but also gifted dead people go to the gods. And living people can have visions of people making the transition from one world to the next. And this is the kind of story one would concoct if one was making up the basic facts of the post-death reality of Jesus. You want an easy message to take to the first century world? Of those first disciples, that's what you take out as the early church into that world. You take a vision out with you into that world. You talk about seeing Jesus getting translated from one reality to another, from grave directly into the heavens. But of course, that's not what happens. The early Christians proclaim a very different message, something very different, radically different, really. They proclaim Jesus Christ crucified, and then raised to life, here, now, not in some promised future, not in some non-material, non-physical vision, but the early Christians proclaimed Jesus Christ crucified and risen, resurrected in a real bodily presence. And there was no historic or mythic parallel for a real resurrection in the ancient world. The translation from one form to another, yes, absolutely, but from death to tangible, restored life? No. And yet that's the message the early church takes out into that world. Jesus raised from the dead. Jesus resurrected in body. Jesus alive in a real, tangible way with people. And the question is, why would they do that? Why would they face the ridicule of the world, of the Jewish world, of the pagan world? The world of Judaism, the religion of all the non-Jews. Why would they suffer the ridicule and scorn for their message? I think it's hard for us to really grasp the challenge the early church faced in taking this message out into that world of theirs. We don't fully understand it today because we've been living with this story for 2,000 years. We've been living with the story of Jesus' resurrection for 2,000 years. For many of us, it's second nature. It's shaped the way we see the world. You know, when Copernicus came up with his idea of the earth rotating around the sun, instead of the sun rotating around the world, it took about 100 years for this idea to percolate out into the universities of Europe. It took much longer to get out into the broader world. Everybody understood that the sun rotates around the earth. That's just second nature. We understand this. If you had been out there in 1590 as a disciple of Copernicus trying to convince people that, no, it's actually the opposite, the earth rotates around the sun, people would have laughed at you. And not just in the local tavern. They would have laughed at you in the halls of the great universities of Europe. The idea was so preposterous that Copernicus didn't even publish his hypothesis until he died. And I think what the early Christians were up against in that first century world was even more challenging than what Copernicus and his ideas faced. What the early church was proclaiming to the world was a greater challenge than convincing people that the earth went around the sun and not its opposite. They had to tell people that the Messiah of the Jews was now the Messiah of the world. And he was crucified by the Romans, and that he had suffered a real death, and now he had suffered a real resurrection. He was standing again in a real tangible way. Muslims have never accepted this part of the Jesus story. They believe Jesus was a prophet of God, that he was a miracle worker, that he was translated into the heavens, but he didn't die on a cross, and he certainly wasn't resurrected. And in our rationalistic, naturalistic culture that we live in today in Canada, in Ontario, Cambridge, Kitchener, Guelph, there's a growing skepticism to the story of Easter. Most people think something might have happened on Easter, something pretty remarkable must have happened, but that Jesus was made alive in a real, tangible way, that the disciples ate with him, conversed with him, had the normal human experiences of life with him. Who can really say? Maybe, but probably not. That's why it would have been so much easier for everyone if the earliest Christians had simply talked about a post-death vision of Jesus. Make it easier for us today, it would have made it easier for them back 2,000 years ago. We could all get on board with that kind of story. Christians, Jews, Gentiles, Muslims, Buddhists, even agnostics could embrace some part of the vision story of Jesus post-death. But that's not the story the early church takes out to the world. And the question is, why didn't they take that story out? Why did they take the hard path? And for me, the answer is very simple. Because that's not how it happened. It wasn't just a vision. It wasn't just a glorious vision. It would have been great if it had, but it wasn't. The first disciples had direct, tangible, intimate interactions with a raised Jesus. Jesus raised from the dead. That's just the way it was. There was nothing they could really do about it. And they had to go out into that world with their experience, even if it was a type of inconvenient truth. Sometimes in life, you get tough messages to convey. A friend of mine, he's a police officer. He's now retired, but he was a police officer for over 30 years. And on a few occasions, he had to go to people's homes and tell them about a loved one in their family who had died. He told me it was the worst part of the job he ever had to do, hardest part, by far. He didn't want to do it. He'd have to go into a home and tell somebody that their husband or their wife had died, or their father or their mother had passed away, or their daughter or their son had passed away. He said it killed him to do it. I mean, not literally, of course, but it really cut him pretty deep to do that kind of thing. But he had to do it. It was his job to bring this most unfortunate news to unsuspecting families. It was necessary, too, as hard as it was. I remember reading years ago about a plant manager in the 1990s. He'd just gotten the news that the plant that he managed was closing down. And it was his job to tell the 700 employees of the plant that they no longer had a job. He talks about the same kind of thing that my friend, the police officer, did, about how he was entrusted with taking this horrible news out to all the people who worked at the plant. The higher-ups had made a decision. He had no say in it, but he had to still convey the message out there to people who didn't want to obviously hear it. And it was probably the worst thing he ever had to do, he said. But it was his job. It was his responsibility. Whatever he thought about the decision itself, it was necessary for him to share this news with all the other people who worked at the plant. It was the necessary thing. It was the right thing for him to do. And you know, sometimes being a follower of Jesus requires us to do the right thing, the necessary thing, even when it is hard. It means we at times have to go against the prevailing philosophy of the times we live in, the prevailing view of things. It means at times we have to go against the morality of our world. At times we have to go against the prevailing ideologies that we've come into contact with. It means that there are times when it's appropriate for us to resist and even promote a different set of ideas, values, priorities. The world that we inhabit today in Southern Ontario as a church, Trillium, or any church, is not a time where people are particularly sympathetic with the Christian message. Many of my personal friends and acquaintances are non-Christians. Most of them don't believe in God. They seem to be quite self-sufficient, even if their lives seem to me at times to be built on a basic hopelessness about it. There are times when I think they have a pointlessness to their life that they don't even seem to fully recognize. There's a sort of a sigh in their lives that they don't seem to fully grasp or understand. I look around and I see a worldwide epidemic of depression and anxiety in people of all ages. I see a deep sense of hopelessness in our youth, a lack of confidence in the future, a deep suspicion of religion and God, all the while people living more and more for themselves. Why not? Nothing ultimately matters anyway. We certainly live in a world that deeply distrusts ancient traditions and the stories that give rise to them. What does a first century Jew living at the margins of a dead empire have to do with people living in 21st century Southern Ontario? It's a fair question. In some ways, that was the question of the first century too. Those first Christian disciples going out into that big world of theirs proclaiming Jesus Christ, crucified and raised from the dead. What did this Jesus have to do with that world either? What did a dead Jew living at the margins of an ancient empire have to do with the lives of millions of people who lived in it and beyond it? But of course, the earliest church didn't take a dead Jesus out into that world with them. Jesus died, of course, but they knew something radically different. Many had experienced it directly. Many others had joined those who had experienced it directly. They had firsthand experience of those who had experienced it directly. They knew the truth that Jesus was alive. He was alive. He was dead at one time, but now he is alive. And even though that was not an easy message to convey to that world of the first century, and it's not an easy message to convey to the world of the 21st century, that is what they were given to do, and that is what we've been given to do. To share the amazing and wonderful news that Jesus is alive. We're not taking a dead Jesus out into the world at Trillium. We're taking one who's alive, who's not to be found among the dead, but who's been raised, risen, who walks with those who welcome him into their heart today. That's incredible news. It's an amazing privilege we've been given here at Trillium. The baton has been passed finally to us, and we have been given the same incredible opportunity to carry the gospel of God out into the world the same way those first disciples were long ago. And just listen to how simple the message can be. Elma read it today in church. This is the words of Peter. His first speech uttered to the world after the resurrection of Jesus, and this is what he says. Now listen to what I have to say about Jesus from Nazareth. God proved he sent Jesus to you by having him work miracles, wonders, and signs. All of you know this. God had already planned and decided that Jesus would be handed over to you, so you took him and had evil men put him to death on a cross. But God set him free from death and raised him to life. Death could not hold him in its power. For me, this is the most amazing thing that's ever happened in all of history. And I love studying history. This is the most amazing thing I've ever come across. The boundary of death has been pierced. God is on the move in life. Even death cannot hold God down in this world. God is on the move. God was on the move. God is on the move. God is on the move in your life and in my life today. We'll talk more about the what is Easter and the why is Easter over the next few weeks. But just remember, just because this is a challenging message to take to the world does not mean it is not worthy of us or immensely important that we share this message to those who we come into contact with. Quite the opposite. It's the most important thing we could ever do with our lives. We just need to learn how to do it. And it begins with knowing the answer to the question, what is Easter? If we all know the answer to that question in our heads and in our hearts, we will not only pass St. Peter's test at the pearly gate, but we will become the vehicle through which God will bring knowledge of his Son to everyone. Death could not hold you. The veil tore before you. You silence the boasts of sin and grave. The heavens are roaring the praise of your glory, for you are raised to life again. What a powerful name it is. What a powerful name it is. The name of Jesus Christ, my King. What a powerful name it is. Nothing can stand against. What a powerful name it is. The name of Jesus.